Great to be back again. I have a very brief purpose right now, and that's to introduce our next speaker. He is a dear friend of mine, a dear friend from before I ran for Congress. He is my congressman from the 6th District of Indiana, has been on the Judiciary Committee and knowledgeable of those issues, most recently as the number three in the Republican leadership, and somebody that many, many people say is going to be a leader not only in our party but in our country. And he's given an interesting talk that I've asked him to share with us today on his view of the presidency and the constitutional parameters for that office. So without further ado, let me give you Mike Pence.
I want to thank my friend David McIntosh, who I not only follow at this podium, but I followed into Congress. And he was a tough act to follow in 2000 when I ran for his seat in Congress. And we've been huffing and puffing to keep up with David McIntosh, one of the storied founders of the Federalist Society here in the United States. And David, I thank you for your leadership and
thank
your friendship.
You.
My topic today is the presidency and the Constitution. And my remarks are derived from a speech that I first had the privilege to give at Hillsdale College just a few short months ago. But I bring it today as a matter of first importance, as our nation embarks on the process of considering not only this president and a presidential contest, but it is my hope that our nation will consider the presidency itself. And it's in that spirit and before this distinguished group of legal minds that I bring my remarks today. The presidency is the most visible thread that runs through the tapestry of the American government. More often than not, for good or for ill, it sets the tone for the other branches, and it spurs the expectations of the people. Its powers are vast and consequential. Its requirements from the outset and by definition, impossible for mortals to fulfill without humility and insistent attention to its purposes as set forth in the Constitution of the United States. Isn't it amazing, given the great and momentous nature of the office, that those who seek it seldom pause to consider what they're seeking? Rather, unconstrained by reflection or principle, there's a mad rush towards something that once its powers are seized, the new president can wield it as an instrument with which to transform the nation and the people according to his highest aspirations. But other than in a crisis of a house divided, the presidency is neither fit nor intended to be such an instrument. When it is made that, the country sustains a wound, and it cries out justly and indignantly, and what the country says, the theme of this address, what it says impelled by its long history, what it says quite naturally and rightly, what it may well have said on November the 2nd, is that we as a people are not to be ruled and not to be commanded. It says that the president should never forget this, that he has not risen above us, but is merely one of us, chosen by ballot, dismissed after his term, tasked not to transform and work his will upon us, but to bear the weight of decision, and to carry out faithfully the design laid down in the Constitution and impassioned by the Declaration of Independence. The presidency must adhere to its definition as expressed in the Constitution and to conduct defined over time and tradition. While the powers of the office have enlarged, along with those of the legislature and the judiciary, the framework of the government was intended to restrict abuses common to the classical empires and to the regal states of the 18th century. Without proper adherence to the role contemplated in the Constitution for the presidency, the checks and balances in the constitutional plan become weakened. This has been most obvious in recent years when the three branches of government have been subject to the tutelage of a single party. Under either party, it seems, presidents have often forgotten that they are intended to restrain the Congress at times, and that the Congress is independent of their desires. And thus fused in some kind of unholy unity, the political class has raged forward in an expansion of power and prerogatives, mistakenly assuming that to exercise power is by default to do good. Even the simplest among us knows that this is not so. Power is an instrument of fatal consequence. It is confined no more readily than quicksilver, and it escapes good intentions as easily as air flows through mesh. Therefore, those who are entrusted with it must educate themselves in self-restraint. A republic, if you can keep it, is about limitation, and for good reason, because we are mortal and our actions are imperfect. The tragedy of presidential decision is that even with the best of choice, some, perhaps many, will be left behind. And some, perhaps many, may die. Because of this, a true statesman lives in what Churchill called a continuous stress of soul. He may give to Paul, but only because he robs Peter. And that's why you must always be wary of a president who seems to float upon his own greatness. For all greatness is tempered by mortality, and every soul is equal. It is a tragedy indeed that new generations taking office attribute failures in governance to insufficient power and invariably seek more of it. In the judiciary, this has seldom been better expressed than by Justice Thurgood Marshall's dictum that you, quote, do what you think is right and let the law catch up, close quote. In the Congress, it presents itself in massive legislation, acts and codes thousands of pages long and so monstrously overcomplicated that no human being could read through them in a lifetime, much less understand them, much less apply them justly to a people that increasingly feel like they're no longer being asked. They feel like they're being told. Our nation finds itself too often of late in the position of a dog whose duty it is not to ask why, because the why is too elevated for his nature. Just simply obey. But America is not a dog and does not require a because I said so jurisprudence to which it is then commanded to catch up, or legislators who knit laws of such insulting complexity that they're heavier than chains, or a president who acts like, speaks like, and is received as a king. The presidency has run off the rails. It begs a new clarity, a new discipline, a new president. The president is not our teacher, our tutor, our guide, or our ruler. He does not command us, we command him. We serve neither him nor his vision. It is not his job or his prerogative to redefine custom, law, and beliefs, to appropriate industries, to seize the country, as it were, by the shoulders or by the throat, as if to impose by the force of theatrical charisma his justice on 300 million people. It is neither his job nor his prerogative to shift the power of decision away from the people to him and to the acolytes of his choosing. Is my characterization of unprecedented presumption incorrect? I defer to the judgment of the people, which they will make in their own eyes and their ears. But listen to the exact words of President Obama's transition team, who said at the point of his election, quote, it's important that President-elect Obama is prepared to really take power and begin to rule day one. Or more recently, from the words of the latest presidential appointment to avoid confirmation by the Senate, the new head of the Financial Consumer Bureau wrote, quote, President Obama understands the importance of leveling the playing field. take power, rule, leveling. Though it is now, this has never been and should never again be the model of the presidency or the character of the American president. No one can say this too strongly. No one can say it enough until it's remedied. We are not subjects, we are citizens. We fought a war so that we don't even have to treat kings like kings. And if I may remind you, we won that one. The powers of the presidency are extraordinary and necessarily great, and great presidents treat them sparingly. No finer, more moving, or profound understanding of the nature of the presidency and the command of humility placed upon it has ever been expressed, in my judgment, than by President Coolidge. He, like Lincoln, lost a child while he was president, a son of 16. "The day I became president," Coolidge wrote, he had just started to work in a tobacco field when one of his fellow laborers said to him, "You know, if my father was president, I would not be working in a tobacco field." To which young Calvin apparently replied, "If my father were your father, you would." His affection for the boy was obvious, and his admiration. While in the White House, President Coolidge's son contracted blood poisoning from an incident on the South Lawn. Coolidge wrote words that resonate with any parent in the room. He wrote, "What might have happened to him under other circumstances, we do not know. But if I had not been president." And then he continued, "In his suffering, he was asking me to make him well, and I could not. And when he went, the power and the glory of the presidency went with him." A sensibility like this, and not power, is the source of presidential dignity, and it must be restored. It depends entirely upon character, self-discipline, and an understanding of the fundamental principles that underlie not only the Republic, but life itself. It communicates that the president feels the gravity of his office and is willing to sacrifice himself, that his eye is not upon his own prospects, but upon the storm of history through which it is his responsibility to navigate with the specific powers accorded to him and the limitations placed upon them, not merely by man, but by God. In the Capitol Rotunda are heroic paintings of the signing of the Declaration, the victory at Saratoga, the victory at Yorktown, and something seldom seen in history, a painting that depicts a general, the leader of an armed rebellion, resigning his commission and surrendering his army to a new democracy. Upon hearing from Benjamin West that George Washington, having won the war and been urged by some to use the army to make himself king, would instead return to his farm, George III said, "If he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world." He did, and he was. To aspire to such virtue and self-restraint would, in a sense, be difficult, but in another sense, it should be easy. Difficult because it would be demanding and ideal, and easy because it's just the right thing to do, and the rewards are immediate and self-evident. A president who slights the Constitution is like a rider who hates his horse. He will be thrown. And the nation along with him. The President solemnly swears to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. He does not solemnly swear to ignore, overlook, supplement, or reinterpret it. Other than in a crisis of morality, decency, and existence, like the Civil War, if he should want to hurry along the Constitution to fit his own notions or designs, he should do so by amendment rather than adjustment. For if he joins the powers of his office to his own willful interpretation, we step away from a government of laws and toward a government of men. The President should regard the Constitution and the Declaration like an obsessed lover. They should be on his mind all the time. The prism through which the light of all questions of governance pass. Though we have sometimes gradually, sometimes radically moved away from this, we can move back to it. And who better than the President to restore this wholesome devotion? Now, whereas at home the President must be cautious, dutiful, and deferential, abroad his character must change. Were he to ask for a primer on how to act in relation to other states, which no holder of the office has needed up to this point, and were that primer to be written by the American people either in 1776 or in 2010, you can be confident it would contain at least the following instructions. First, you do not bow to kings. Outside our borders, the President of the United States bows to no man. When in foreign lands, you do not criticize your own country. You do not argue the case against the United States, but rather the case for it. You do not apologize to the enemies of the United States of America. Now, and should you be confused, let me help. A country, people, or region that harbors, shelters, supports, or encourages, or cheers attacks upon our country are enemies of the United States of America, and you do not apologize to them. Closely related to this, and perhaps the least ambiguous of the President's complex responsibilities, is his duty as Commander-in-Chief. In this regard, there's a very simple rule, unknown to some presidents, regardless of party. If, and it's the biggest if any president can face, for it will follow not just him, but hundreds of thousands or millions of others, not just for the rest of their lives, but in cost of blood and souls beyond life itself. If. And it's an if that requires long and deep thought, tremendously hard labor at determining the truth of things, a lifetime of education, the knowledge of a general, the wisdom of a statesman, in the heart of an infantryman. If, after careful deliberation, intense stress of soul, and the deepest prayer, if then you go to war, then having gone to war, by God, you go to war to win. You do not cast away American lives or those of the innocent non-combatant upon a theory, a gambit, or a notion. And if the politics of your own election or your own party intrude upon your decision for even an instant, there are no words for this. More commonplace but hardly less important are other expectations of the President in this regard. He must not stint on the equipment and the provisioning of our armed forces. If he errs, it must not be on the side of scarcity, but on the side of surplus. He must be the guardian of his troops, taking every step to avoid the loss of even a single American life. The American soldier is as precious as the closest of your kin, because he is your kin. And for his sake, the president must, in effect, say to the Congress and to the people, I am the commander-in-chief. It is my sacred duty to defend the United States of America and to give our soldiers what they need to complete their mission and come home safe. In fulfilling this duty, if the president wavers, he will have betrayed his office. For this is not policy, it is probity. And it is not an expedient artifact of imagination. It is written on the blood-soaked ground of Saratoga, Yorktown, Antietam, Cold Harbor, Guadalcanal, Point du Hoc, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and 1,000 other places in our history in lessons repeated over and over again. The presidency. A great and complex subject upon which I have only touched has become symbolic of overreaching. There are many truths that we have been frightened to tell or face. If we run from them, they will catch us with our backs turned and pull us down. Better that we should not flee, but rather stop and look them in the eye. What might our forebears say to us, knowing what they knew and having done what they did? I have no doubt that they would tell us to channel our passions, speak the truth simply, and do what's right, slowly and with resolution, to work calmly, steadily, without animus or fear, to be like a rock in the tide, let the water tumble about us, and be firm and unashamed in our love of country. You know, I see us like those first Federalists back in 1776. Danger all around, but a fresh chapter, ready to begin, uncorrupted, with great possibilities, and inexplicably, perhaps miraculously, the way is clearing ahead. I've never doubted that providence can appear in history like the sun emerging from behind the clouds, if only as a reward for adherence to first principles. As Churchill said before Congress in December of 1941, he must indeed have a blind soul who cannot see that some great purpose and design is being worked out here below, of which we have the honor to be faithful servants. A long time ago, during the tortured history of Rome, in the 4th century AD, the Emperor Constantius was faced with an ultimatum backed by what appeared to be military force impossible to resist. Failure and defeat seemed certain to everyone, but in the morning, when his answer was due, he said to his assembled troops, last night, after I retired to rest, the shade of the great Constantine rose before my eyes, and his well-known voice forbade me to despair of the Republic. We too have voices of shades who emerge from our past. We too have what Lincoln in his first inaugural address called the mystic cords of memory stretching from every patriot grave. They bind us to the great and to the humble, the known and the unknown. And if I hear them clearly, what they say is that although we may have strayed, we have not strayed too far to return, for we are, every one of us, their descendants. The sinews are still there, quite lively, waiting to flex. We can still astound the world with justice, reason, and strength. I know this is true. But even if it were not, we could not in decency stand down, if only for our debt to history. The debt we owe to those who came before, who did great things, who suffered more than we suffer, who gave more than we give, who pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor for us, whom they did not know. For we dig from wells, or we drink from wells we did not dig, and are warmed by fires we did not build. And so we must be faithful in our time, as they were faithful in theirs. Many great generations are gone, but I see them in my mind's eye. By the character and memory of their existence, they forbid us to despair of our republic. I see them crossing the prairies in the sun and the wind. I see their faces looking out from steel mills and coal mines and immigrant ships crawling into the harbors at dawn. I see them at war, at work, and at peace. I see them long departed, looking into the camera with hopeful and sad eyes. I see them embracing their children, who became us. They are our family and our blood. We cannot desert them. In spirit, all of them come down to us in a connection that out of love we cannot betray. They are silent now, but from the eternal silence of every patriot grave, there is yet an echo that says, "It's not too late. Keep faith with us. Keep faith in God. And do not ever despair of this republic." Thank you. God bless you. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today.